On Jordan's stormy banks I stand, and cast a wishful eye to Canaan's fair and happy land, where my possessions lie. You know, we have a number of our hymns that talk about Jordan. Specifically, it's referring to the Jordan River. But it's not referring to the river in its literal, physical, historical sense, as we read about it in the Bible, but it's using the Jordan as a symbol, as a figurative way of talking about some other things. So I've taken the liberty this morning to borrow a sermon that in its essence was preached 120 years ago by a man by the name of J.W. McGarvey. He was one of the early, about third generation preachers in the Restoration Movement. I hope you know that historically the Churches of Christ are part of a movement that started in the early 1800s in America that came to be called the Restoration Movement, the desire to restore New Testament Christianity. We weren't the first Restoration Movement, and we haven't been the last, but we're one of the largest that has occurred and continues to live to this day, with the idea that we want to know what New Testament Christianity looked like, what they believed, what they did, what the church was like, and we want to imitate that and be as much like that as possible. That's restoration. Well, J.W. McGarvey was a powerful leader and preacher in the Restoration Movement in the second half of the 19th century, in other words, the late 1800s. And I have a book of his sermons. And one of the sermons in that book is called The Jordan River. That's just the title of it. But he talks about that, and I've long been impressed that he would speak on that subject, and so I've chosen to look basically at the same subject he did and talk about that this morning, because it does shade a lot of our thinking about certain spiritual things. It helps, however, to know what the truth is about the Jordan that would cause some of our songwriters to borrow it and use it to describe the things that we tend to think about. The Jordan River is probably the most noted river in the Bible. Certainly there's a few other rivers mentioned from time to time, but no other nearly as often, nor is it nearly as significant, are they nearly as significant in the Bible as the Jordan is. And it's one of the most famous rivers in the world. But it's not famous for the same reason some of the others are. We think about the great Mississippi here in the United States, its great length, its great size, its great watershed, the amount of water that it carries, how important it is to our country, the amount of commerce that flows up and down it, even today, along with the great cities that line its shores like St. Louis and Baton Rouge and New Orleans and so forth. The Jordan isn't anything like the Mississippi. It's not anything like the Nile River, one of the longest, along with the Mississippi, one of the longest rivers in the world. The Nile is so unique in that a whole nation exists and has existed from antiquity simply because the Nile exists. And that's the nation of Egypt. If it were not for the Nile River, there would not be and never would have been an Egypt. All of the life of Egypt, even today, still comes from the Nile. Nile is kind of unique in that it flows north instead of south. It's not the only river in the world that does that, but one of the few. Nor is the Jordan significant in the same way that the Yangtze and the Yellow Rivers in China are. Those two rivers, in some ways like the Nile, gave life to the culture of China. And they flow through the very heartland of that great nation, and a lot of their commerce flows up and down it, and they have great cities along its banks, and it provides not only commerce, but transportation and even food for its people. And there's other rivers we could mention as well that are well known for that. But the Jordan is not like any of those rivers. It's not nearly as long as they are. It's not located in nearly as important positions as they are in terms of commerce or things like that. So what is it famous for? Why is it so famous? First of all, it's famous, of course, because of the historic events that are associated with it in the pages of the Bible. And I wouldn't want to imply that but just because there are historic events in the pages of the Bible that they're somehow less historic or historical than other history. For, in fact, the Bible is a book of history, and these things did, in fact, really happen. They just happen to be recorded for us in the pages of the Bible. But it's also notable because of some of its peculiarities. We seldom talk about how peculiar the Jordan River actually is, even when we're talking about its historical significance. But it's because of its history and its even maybe some of its peculiarities that it has ended up becoming, for the Christian faith especially, and to a lesser degree the Jewish faith, a symbol of certain things that we hold dear and we see as very significant. Let me tell you a little bit about how unique the Jordan River is. Just think about some of the things concerning it. It's mentioned about 180 times in the Old Testament, some 15 times by name in the New. And that's far more than any other river. And in fact, most other geographic features in the Holy Land are not mentioned as often as it is. But what is so unusual about it is not often mentioned in the Bible itself. The people who actually lived there, the writers who knew the Jordan, because it was just like it's there. You know, from the day they're born to the day they die, the Jordan is always there. And their first audiences were as familiar with the Jordan as they were, so they didn't need to tell them the unusual things about the Jordan. But we need to know some of it. The Jordan River stretches for the length of the Holy Land. The source of the Jordan comes from the foothills of the great Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon is a huge mountain that is at the very top of what was ancient Holy Land. At the foot of Mount Hermon was a city by the name of Dan. It was the northernmost city in Israel. And just outside of Dan is a fountain, a spring that comes flowing up out of the ground, being fed from the mountain that stands up behind it, and the snows that cover the top of Mount Hermon basically year-round. But as it melts in the spring, particularly, that water soaks into the mountain and then springs up from underground in one place there near Dan, and that water starts flowing south. It soon joins another spring from another side of Mount Hermon that has done the same thing. And then about a mile further downstream, a third fountain or spring starts to feed into it. All three of these springs draw their water from what falls from Mount Hermon. In effect, you could say that the water from the Jordan comes straight from heaven, because it comes straight from the snow that comes from the clouds that gather over the mountain every winter and make that snow so abundant. These are the three sources of the Jordan. And as it starts to flow south, as these three springs feed together, it quickly reaches sea level. It doesn't start out very far above sea level to start with, just within about 10 or 11 miles at the most. It reaches sea level. Of course, it's a long way from the sea, the Mediterranean being the closest off to the west, maybe 45 or 50 miles. But it reaches sea level and it spreads out into a little lake. That lake is seldom mentioned in the Bible. It is called today Lake Merom. And even in some cases, I think it's called Lake Miriam, but really Lake Merom is the name of it, a small lake about 4.5 miles long. Lake Merom is sort of set in a marshy area, but in the center of it is this lake about 4.5 miles long, 3.5 miles wide at its widest. And the river doesn't stop there. It flows out the southern end. But as it flows out the southern end, it leaves this marshy area that has been created because of its flow there and enters into what we would actually call a kind of small canyon, a gorge, that then flows south about 11 more miles into the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Galilee draws almost all of its water from the Jordan River, just like Lake Merom. And the Galilee is larger than Lake Merom. It's about 12 and a half miles long, some three times as long, and about twice as wide or more than Lake Merom was. So it's a much larger body of water. And it plays a significant part in the Bible, we know. Mentioned Old and New Testament numerous times, especially the New, since a lot of Jesus' ministry took place around the shores of Lake Galilee, or the Sea of Galilee, as it was often called. He even did a great number of things on the Sea of Galilee, including fishing, sailing across it, walking on it, stopping the storm on it. But it's being fed by the Jordan. But then at the southern end of the Galilee, here comes the river again. It flows out. This is a very unique thing about the Jordan. It's not the only river in the world, probably, that flows into and out of two lakes and continues on, but it's one of the few. And then it flows for about 65 miles more south, mostly through gorges and canyons, largely inaccessible from the countryside on either side. In other words, you can't just walk down to the edge of the river and wade across to the other side again, because it's down in a small canyon. It would be difficult to get down to and back up on the other side. There are a few crossings along the way, but mostly like that. But just before it reaches its destination, some 65 miles south, it opens out into a floodplain that is the floodplain of Jericho and flows into the Dead Sea. So here we have this river that starts at the foot of a mountain, flows through two lakes, and ends in a Dead Sea. It flows in, but it doesn't flow. And by the time it reaches the Dead Sea, it is at a level of some 1,300 feet below sea level. So this is a river that through most of its existence flows below sea level. Because by the time it got to Lake Merom, just about 12 miles after it began, it's already at sea level, and everything from there is downhill and under the level of the sea. Unlike many other rivers, it does not flow into a true sea like an ocean. The other great rivers we mentioned, Mississippi, the Yangtze, the Nile, the Yellow River, or even we could have mentioned the Amazon as well, all of those flow into the ocean somewhere, not the Jordan. It flows into this sea called the Dead Sea. And because there's no exit out of the Dead Sea over the millennia from God's creation until now, that Dead Sea has caught all the flow of the Jordan, and as the water has evaporated off, the water in that sea has become more and more salty and more filled with the minerals that the water of the Jordan has brought down in. And so now the Dead Sea is a sea, and even in Bible times it's already a sea, that the water was far too salty to drink or to support any kind of life. There's no fish in it. There's nothing in there that lives of any significance. And because it's got such a high salt content, you'll sometimes see today even pictures of people, quote, swimming in the Dead Sea. And actually, when you look at them, they're laying on top of the water. You know, I've always had a problem. I don't know why. It's not because I'm thin anymore, because I'm not particularly thin. But I always had a trouble when I got in water, a swimming pool or a river or a pond or whatever like that. I was lucky if I'm laying on my back that my nose would stick up out of the water so I wouldn't drown. But if I were to lay down in the Dead Sea, almost my entire body would be up out of the water. There's so much salt in there. The density of the water is greater than the density of our human bodies, and so it supports us almost like a bed. It's a strange, peculiar thing, one of the few places on earth where that happens. But here's this river that feeds that Dead Sea. Now, the Dead Sea today is losing water. The Jordan River over the last 50 or 60 years is not getting as much snow from the Hermon, and more water is being pulled out of the Jordan by Israel and the other nations that line its shores for irrigation, for their farming operations and so forth. And so less water is flowing into the Dead Sea. And the Dead Sea is actually shrinking. And there's some things that have been discovered in recent years about the Dead Sea that we didn't know before. The Dead Sea right now is actually in two parts. There's a bridge that goes over the middle of it, an earth bridge, because the water has dropped low enough that they've discovered that there's actually a high place that spreads across it between the two. So you can actually walk across the Dead Sea right now, understand, from one side to the other, if you want to walk that 7.5 miles without more than getting your feet damp. And at the southern end of it, they're discovering the remains of what some believe and may well be the remains of Sodom and Gomorrah now, that have been covered up by the waters for hundreds and hundreds of years when the water level was higher. But now that it's dropped, it may be something more like what it was in the days of Abraham and of Lot in the Old Testament. And so this unique river flows through two lakes, dead ends into another lake that has become the Dead Sea. Interestingly enough, because of the physical characteristics around the river, very few settlements of any size have ever existed for very long along its shores. Even in Bible times, we don't find a mention of towns or villages that were located right along the shores of the Jordan River. The nearest thing we come to that is the city of Jericho. And Jericho is some 5 miles away from where the Jordan flows into the Dead Sea. So even it's not along the shores itself. We've also have discovered, and this is never mentioned in the Bible, but over the last 100 years, surveyors and explorers have discovered that the Jordan, while it flows south, does not by any stretch of the imagination flow in a straight line. For example, when it comes out of Galilee and flows down to the Dead Sea, they say in straight distance, that's about 65 miles. But in truth, if you actually got in a boat and travel the river itself, you would travel over 200 miles to go from the exit out of the Sea of Galilee to the entrance into the Dead Sea. So it doesn't travel in anything like a straight line. It's flowing back and forth in a serpentine shape. It's not navigable. And by that, we mean that boats of size enough to carry commerce or things like that can't travel the entire distance of it. Small boats can travel a good bit of the distance between Galilee and the Dead Sea, but beyond that, it's really not navigable. Very little good farmland actually is located along its shores. The farmland is off a distance on either side by several miles. Again, partly because it's flowing through canyons and gorges through most of its distance, and they have to draw water out of it by irrigation even to get water to their land. And it's the only significant river. There are a couple of other small rivers, but they scarcely even get a mention either in the Bible or even by Israelis today. There's just that one river of any significance at all in the Holy Land. But that's just the geographic part of it. What about the history behind it? I mentioned already that in the days of Abraham, one of the first characters we read of in the Bible who lived in that land. Certainly there were others already living there, but he's the first mentioned that we're interested in. He and Lot end up dividing part of the land, and the Jordan River played a significant part in that. When Lot saw the land more to the south of the Dead Sea that benefited from some of the water that went ahead and seeped out of the lake, even without the salt, and had watered the plains of the Jordan, as it was called, he wanted to live down there because not only were there several significant cities there, but there was a place for feeding his flocks of sheep and goats and maybe other things. But the first big events that start happening in the Bible having to do with the Jordan have to do when God brings his people out of Egypt, guided by Moses for 40 years, and they come up on the eastern side of the Jordan just north of the Dead Sea. And by this time, Moses is quite elderly, about 120 years of age, because of his rebellion against God at one point during their 40 years in the wilderness, God is not going to allow him to go into the land of promise. But God allows him, in fact instructs him, to climb up on to the Mount Nebo that's there on just off from the eastern side of the Jordan River. And there from one of the promontories of Nebo called Pisgah, he can stand and he can look down and see the Jordan. He can see the Dead Sea. He can see over into the Promised Land. He can see it, but God will not let him go in. And he dies up there on the mountain, and God buries him. The scriptures say the nation that is down at the foot of the mountain waiting to go into the Promised Land is now in the hands of Joshua. And we have this great story recorded in Joshua chapter 3 and 4, how as the people, probably numbering some anywhere from, depending on the scholar who estimates it, from 1.5 million to 3 million people are gathered there on the eastern side of the Jordan River. They're ready to go over into the land that God had promised them, but there's some problems. The biggest of them at that moment is that at that time it's the fall of the year, or at least at the time of the year, I guess I don't know for sure if it's a fall, it's the time of the year when the Jordan was flooding from the melt-off, so that probably would actually mean late spring. It's flooding from the melt-off from Hermon, so the river is much wider and deeper than normal. In the drier parts of the year, there actually are some places where small groups of people can ford the river on foot that wade across maybe no more than waist deep to get across the river, but this time of year, that's not practical. And not only is it just the people, but they've got their families, their wagons, their possessions, everything to take with them. And so God gives instruction on what they're to do. And so Joshua gets together the priests who are carrying the Ark of the Covenant, and he tells them that they are to walk to the river, and they'll just keep walking. And so when they walk and when their foot touches the water stops flowing, and it backs up. The river that's flowing south just keeps going, but the river that hadn't got, part of the river that hadn't gotten there, here stops. And so suddenly God gives them some semblance of what had happened 40 years ago after they had come out of Egypt, when he had opened up the Red Sea for them to pass through it. Now he opens up the Jordan River for them to pass through. And the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant on their shoulders walk down into the middle of the bed of the river, and they stand there holding the Ark. And the scriptures say all the people hurry across. That means that even though they see it happening, they're not going to just trust that God's going to hold it there forever. So they move across as quickly as they can. And when all the people are over on the western side of the now into the promised land, then Joshua calls for the priests to come up out of the riverbed. And so as they come walking up out of the riverbed, as soon as they reach the shore on the western side, the water starts flowing again. God really closed the door behind them. He said, now you're committed. You had enough faith at last to trust me to get this far. Now you're here. And from that point, they'll go on to conquer the city of Jericho by that peculiar military strategy of marching around it every day and sounding trumpets till God gives it to them. And eventually they'll go on to conquer the whole land. The last battle to take the land takes place all the way up at Lake Merom, all the way up to the northern end of the Jordan River, where Joshua and part of his army conquers the last of the Canaanites, and the land is there. The next time we hear about the Jordan in any significant way is in the days of King David, 500 years later. David is facing a rebellion among his own people. His son, Absalom. Absalom has won over part of David's own army and even one of his generals. And Absalom, with an army, with David's own generals and with the support of some of the people, he marches on Jerusalem, the capital city, and David has to flee along with his family and the royal court. And they go down to the Jordan River and cross over the Jordan and seek refuge on the eastern side. One of David's wives' father was the ruler of a city on the eastern side of the Jordan River, and so they go over there and seek refuge, and from there David assembles his own army and devises a strategy for retaking his kingdom from his own son, and he launches his campaign to recapture his country from there. The next time we hear about Jordan with any significance is in the days of Elijah and Elisha. This is in 2 Kings chapter 2, in the days of King Ahab and Queen Jezebel and their great wickedness up in the nation of Israel. By that time, the kingdom is divided into two, Israel in the north, Judah in the south. And Elijah was a great prophet of God during that time. And lots of stories could be told about him. But as Elijah's come to near the end of his life, he looks for someone under God's guidance to pass his ministry on to. And he chooses a great, strong, physical man by the name of Elisha. And Elisha becomes Elijah's disciple, his protege, and Elijah is his mentor. And when finally Elijah knows it's time for him to go, perhaps to die, he thinks, he decides that he's going to go down and cross over the Jordan, over to the eastern shore, and out into the wilderness there where he believes that he will die. Well, Elisha won't be separated from him. He knows what's happening, and he is determined to stay with Elijah. And so when they reach the Jordan River, Elijah takes off the cloak that he's wearing and rolls it up and strikes the water with his cloak. And when he does, the water stops and opens up. Did you know that story? It's there in 2 Kings 2, verse 8. And Elijah and Elisha walk across the Jordan on dry ground. When they reach the other side, the river closes up and continues its flow. And they go out into the wilderness, and as Elijah keeps trying to make Elisha stay here while I go over there, and Elisha won't get away from him. Finally, suddenly, a fiery chariot comes down out of the heavens and sweeps down. And Elijah gets on board, and it goes back up into the heavens and disappears. But as it's leaving, Elijah drops his cape, and Elisha picks and puts it on. The ministry is now his. There were some other prophets of the school of the prophets who also had followed them. They were off at a greater distance, but they also see all of this. And then as Elisha starts his way back, backtracking the way they had come, when he gets to the Jordan River, he takes the same cape off, he rolls it up, he strikes the water just like Elijah had, and it stops and opens up. And he walks across. And when he gets on the other side, it closes up and continues its flow. Pretty significant story. But it's demonstrated, what God allowed it to demonstrate, was that he was now with Elisha the way he had been. And great things happen in the days of Elisha as well. More time passes. Then we hear about a man by the name of Naaman. He was not a Jewish man. He was a Syrian. He was a general in the Syrian army. Probably their capital city was up in Aram, which is a part of what in later New Testament times was called Damascus, and that area up there. But during the time when they had been attacking the nation of Israel, they had taken some prisoners, and among those prisoners was a young Jewish girl who became a servant in his house. And it was obvious to everyone that Naaman had a problem. He was in his country. They didn't treat leprosy the way we do in ours, as a communicable disease, and everybody ought to be isolated and all that. So he pretty much carried on business as usual, but he had leprosy. And this young girl tells her mistress that if her master were only in Israel, there was a prophet there who could heal him. That was great faith on his or her part. But when the word gets through the wife to the husband that there's a prophet in Israel that could possibly heal him of his leprosy, then with the permission of the king, and even actually papers from the king of Aram, he goes to Israel looking for the prophet. And he gets word from the prophet Elisha that if he'll go and wash 7 times in the Jordan River, he will be clean. Well, the part of the Jordan he would know about would be that northern part that flowed out of Dan down into Lake Merom and then through that marshy area and then the gorge all the way down to the Sea of Galilee, that northern, smaller part of the river. And that's probably why he said, well, back in our country, we have 2 rivers that are much nicer than that river. And at first, he wouldn't do it. But finally, his servants convinced him, what would it cost him? It would be nothing. If it didn't work, he would have only gotten wet. But if it did work, he would have gained everything. So he does go and wash in the Jordan River and is healed. And that's really about the last time we hear about the Jordan River in the Old Testament. And we only hear about it in the New of any significance with 2 events. Number one was the preaching of John the Baptist. When John began his ministry, he began his ministry along the shores of the Jordan River, calling on people to repent and be baptized and prepare for the coming of the kingdom of God. That he was the forerunner of the promised Messiah mentioned over and over in the Old Testament. And so people came out to him from all of Israel, including Jerusalem, to hear him preach. And thousands were baptized by him in the Jordan River. Now, the Jordan River wasn't the only place he could have baptized people. So there must have been some kind of significance, symbolic significance, for him using the Jordan. And I think it was those stories from the Old Testament, how the people had originally crossed that river to come into the Promised Land. Now they needed to come back to the Jordan to prepare for the new Promised Land that God had prepared for them. At least that's my thinking of why God would have chosen to have him baptized at the Jordan. It also meant that those who were really serious about believing the message of John would come. Now, if he had been preaching and baptizing him in Jerusalem, it made it easy for everybody because that's where a large amount of the population was located. But instead, they had to make this trek, a very dangerous trek, by the way, from Jerusalem down to Jericho and into the Jordan to be baptized. So I think that sort of indicated only the really serious people were going to do that. And they weren't going to do it just because of peer pressure. They were going to do it because of true conviction. And among those that he baptized was one day his cousin, a man by the name of Jesus, who comes and presents himself to John to be baptized. And that's where our scripture that was read this morning comes in Matthew 3:13. Then Jesus came from Galilee to the Jordan to be baptized by John. But John tried to deter him, saying, I need to be baptized by you, and do you come to me? And Jesus replied, let it be so now. It is proper for us to do this to fulfill all righteousness. Then John consented. And as soon as Jesus was baptized, he went up out of the water, At that moment, heaven was open, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and lighting on him. And a voice from heaven said, "This is my Son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased." God did miraculous things at the birth of his Son. We talked about that some last week. That's what's often pictured in some of the religious celebrating surrounding Christmas. The angels in the sky that night, the other things that accompanied that. But now, as he is about to begin his ministry, the work that God has given him to do, God once more puts his stamp of approval on it by doing something miraculous. A voice from heaven that probably not only John, but all those there heard that day, in which God said, "This is my Son, and I love him." And God is saying that he was well pleased, that he was doing God's will. And then we don't really hear anything else about the Jordan in the Bible after that. It still flows there today. It's still a part of that land today. But as far as God's scheme of things is concerned, its work was done. Its work was done. So what's the connection between that and the way we often talk about the Jordan River today? We have this large number of hymns in our, maybe not a large number, we have a number of hymns in our songbook that talk about the Jordan River. I have a home prepared where the saints abide, just over in the glory land. That's talking about we've got to cross over something to get there, just like the ancient Israelites did, or the one I quoted at the beginning, "On Jordan's stormy banks I stand, a wishful eye, to Canaan's fair and happy land where my possessions lie." There's actually two versions of that. The other one has the same words for the main part of it, but then the chorus says, "I am bound for the promised land, I'm bound for the promised land." One that, not in our songbooks, I don't know if we'd actually want to call it a hymn or not, but it was made famous by Johnny Cash, at least, called "I Won't Have to Cross Jordan Alone." Or one that is in our hymn book, "Jordan River, I'm Bound to Cross." I don't know if you are familiar with that one or not. Then one that's not in our hymn books, but in the older ones that we use, I think, on Sunday night sometime, "There's a Land Beyond," that they call the great. And the chorus talks about when they ring those golden bells for you and me. All of these songs are picturing Jordan as a place of crossing. Sometimes it's talking about death itself and talking about Jordan as if it's death. But more often it's talking about what's over on the other side. In Hebrews chapter 4, it talked about that when Joshua led the people across the river, he led them over into the promised land to give them rest, but they didn't find rest there. And that there therefore still remains a place of rest for the people of God. And so in a figurative sense, we still have to cross over into that land of rest God has prepared for us. And for the majority of us, probably that means we'll pass through death to get there. But there's also that promised land, heaven. Eternity, God's golden city, that place where we look to go. And it's all figured or prefigured by the Jordan River. This place that was a place that they crossed back and forth to get into the promised land, to escape from their enemies in some cases, or even as they went down in the days of John to be baptized, to prepare themselves to go to that kingdom that "Roll, Jordan, roll," one of the old hymns says. And in a figurative sense, that's what we still have ahead. We have one more song in our songbook that says, "Shall we gather at the river?" You know, that one's not actually talking about Jordan. That's talking about that river that flows from that we read about in Revelation. But even that river is sort of a figurative version of the physical Jordan that all those people, all of us, whether figuratively or literally, face that time when we will pass from this life, whether we want to call it crossing Jordan or whatever we want to call it, and we'll stand and face it. And we want to be ready for that day. People full of faith, people full of confidence, people who are ready to go to that land beyond the river.